case was, pretty much.
And I will make sure that no one asks you the direct questions.
I don't care. They can ask what they want. They can ask whatever they want. But I'm able. You know, I don't always answer.
But jump in on, you know, if he's talking about Mugabe or Chile or anything else. Globally, but there's so many domestic analogs.
Definitionally in South Africa, ask if we could talk a little bit about overcoming the legacy of race, jump around from there.
I'm going to talk about the Canadian Truth Commission.
I don't know anything about Truth Commission.
That's all right.
And I know some of the things that happened with the Indian. I know some of the things about Indian law, not much. I know a little bit about what happened with the Japanese in the race question. I mean, I know some of the things that people tried to do with Little Rock. Mm-hmm. They went around giving talks and so forth. How long did this last?
Just an hour.
You're the expert.
It's frightening to think of it that way.
Yeah, you are.
Is the microphone on? Oh, I guess it is. Ladies and gentlemen, if you could come in, take a seat, come to the front as much as possible so we can have this as conversational as we can make it. As this is going to be taped and broadcast, I'd ask all of you, remind all of you to please turn off your BlackBerries. That's preferable. If that's too much for you to endure, if you could at least put them on silent. I'm Elliot Gerson, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this panel, which I think will be extremely interesting, and comparing both some domestic and international aspects of the question about transitional justice. Certainly, Justice Stephen Breyer needs no introduction, really, an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court since 1994, a distinguished appellate judge before that, a law professor, and also someone with direct and significant experience in the executive and legislative branches of the United States government. Familiar face here at Aspen. We're very fortunate to have him here frequently. He not only writes wonderful opinions, but he's one of the, I think, two rare justices who also takes opportunities to speak publicly. Obviously, there are going to be some topics and occasions, perhaps some that would come up today, where he cannot answer as directly as he might otherwise because there are matters that could come before the court. Paul Fonsele is someone who probably knows more and has more experience in transitional justice and is now associated very much with this concept around the world. He founded the International Center for Transitional Justice, an organization that assists countries that are pursuing justice, accountability, responsibility, and reparations for past abuse or atrocities of the preceding government. It was really his seminal experience as the director of the Truth and Reconciliation a Commission in South Africa that provided the foundation for his work. And I think it's fair to say the fact that his work is now in such demand is of course a mixed blessing, that nations wish to accept responsibility for abuses of their predecessors, typically in a transition from an autocratic to a democratic society, is obviously a hugely positive sign. But the fact that there is as much demand there is for such commissions and activity, not only from legacies of the 20th century, but things still occurring in the 21st century, is quite another matter as to what it might suggest about unchecked political power and human nature. But let's start, if we can, Paul, with perhaps a definition of transitional justice. Somewhat of an awkward phrase. My guess is many of you, if you didn't go back to our booklet, and we make it very difficult for you to know really what you're coming to, and just see a definition, transitional justice, sort of an awkward term. What does it mean? And then we'll jump directly into the South African experience.
Well, transitional justice is how societies come to terms with and reckon with a legacy of mass atrocity and human rights abuse. And I think one of the reasons why it's assumed such prominence in recent years is because there's now a growing body of binding law which obligates states who have experienced genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, other forms of systemic human rights abuse, to firstly prosecute and punish those people responsible, to uncover the truth about the crimes and the fate and whereabouts of victims, to offer reparation to the victims, and to take a set of steps to prevent these crimes from occurring again in the future. And that, coupled with the fact that we now have a decent historical experience, we've seen transitions in Latin America, we saw the transition from apartheid to democracy in South Africa, we saw countries under the former rule of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe transition to more democratic regimes. We now have a body of experience which says, in fact, there are intelligent and principled ways to deal with the past, and there are dangerous ways to deal with the past, and doing it intelligently can have a decisive effect on both the quality of democracy and the nature of human rights in the new regimes.
Let's talk about how it can be done intelligently and talk about your experience in South Africa. I guess along with Chile and Argentina, perhaps even more so than either of those, that example is really paradigmatic of how a society comes to terms with its own previous horrors. You know, don't give us statistics, but maybe you can tell us a story or stories about that and what it's meant and the lessons learned from that.
Well, one of the things that the new government, Nelson Mandela's government in South Africa, had to reckon with is how do we move forward after the terrible and systematic human rights abuse that occurred under apartheid, and how do we do it in a way that doesn't disrupt this fragile embryonic democracy that's just been born? So one of the things that they did was establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and that commission's primary purpose was to give victims a voice, to allow people who had experienced unimaginable suffering, give them an opportunity to tell their stories, not only so that the country would have knowledge about what happened under apartheid, but that there would also be official acknowledgement that what happened was morally wrong and unacceptable, and that the new society commits itself to ensure it never happens again. So to perhaps breathe life into it, I can tell you one story. One of the things we did is, on a stage somewhat like this, organize hearings about across the country. About 24,000 victims gave their statements to the Truth Commission, and about 2,500 of them gave public testimony in front of a commission headed up by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And one of the people who came before us at one of our very first hearings was a woman called Joyce Mtumkulu. And Joyce came to tell us the story of her son, Sipiwe, who was a young youth activist who had done work in the Eastern Cape organizing against the effects of apartheid and education in particular. He was a very strapping, charismatic young man. And as a result of that, attracted the attention of the security police in South Africa. They arrested and detained him and put him into detention. At that point, there was detention without trial in South Africa. You couldn't see a doctor or a lawyer or a relative. You were held incommunicado. And he emerged about 6 months later in a wheelchair, unable to walk, unable to talk, having lost most of his hair. And he was sent to the United States and subjected to a battery of tests. And it was discovered that while he was in detention, he had been poisoned with thallium, which is a tasteless, colorless, odorless drug, very difficult to detect. And so lawyers acting on behalf of Sipiwe immediately launched a lawsuit against the Minister of Law and Order, the person responsible for our police. And while Sipiwe was undergoing treatment one night in a hospital, and he was getting better, he began to walk again, his hair began to grow back, his speech began to come back, he simply disappeared. So Joyce came to a hall, about 5,000 people of it, to tell the story as I've just told it to you, and then to say, you don't know what it's like to have a son who's disappeared. And she recounted in great detail how Sipiwe had been born, how she'd breastfed him, how she'd watched him go from a toddler to a teenager. And then how every time there was a knock on the door, every time the phone rang, every time she heard footsteps in the corridor, she thought that it might be Sipiwe, her son, who was returning. But she knew in her heart of hearts that he'd been abducted and killed. And at one moment, she reached down beneath the table, took out from a plastic packet what looked like a ball of black wool, but was in fact a ball of Sipiwe's hair that she had kept from when he was convalescing, and held it up to Archbishop Tutu and to the commission, but to the whole country, and really, because this was being televised live on national television, and said, "This is all I have left of my son, and you need to tell me what happened to my son." And so through the work of the Truth Commission, we investigated the case. And the perpetrators who committed the crime were entitled to apply for amnesty, provided they made full disclosure of their crime. So they came forward and disclosed the fact that they'd abducted him from his hospital bed, that they had poisoned him, that they'd burnt his body on a pyre, thrown his ashes into a river. And they had done so to avoid the embarrassment of the legal case. And so we were able to organize a funeral for Sipiwe at the place that he had been disappeared, where he'd been thrown into the river. Archbishop Tutu presided. And it gave a measure of closure. We obtained truth, but we didn't get justice. And that was one of the terrible trade-offs and compromises we had to make in South Africa as we dealt with the legacy of abuse.
Justice Breyer, we don't really have quite, obviously, the legacy of slavery is different in many respects from apartheid, but we have our own legacies in the United States that we are attempting to overcome in a democratic fashion over time. And I wonder if you could comment at all on how legislation, 14th Amendment, might be a way to address our own legacies and how as a democratic mechanism of a society coming to terms with its past, our constitutional mechanism operates, you know, whether it's African Americans or even Native Americans.
Well, it's whether we have problems of the sort you described or not. And to what extent, I don't know. I would say the legal system, court branch, is not a very good way to deal with it. If there is a case we could deal with, possibly it's the one you described, because you have a specific individual, and if you could get the evidence of the crime, and if, you see, that's quite a big if, then, and if you have the right person, then you can prosecute the person. But look at the ifs. And the more time goes on, the harder it is to do. Let me give you an example. Example one, I would say, are the American Indians. Because I'm interested in that subject, I know in 1830 how the government just took the land and drove the Cherokees to Georgia. Well, when they got around to making up for that, it was probably 100 years later. The courts couldn't make up for it, though you can say that in a number of cases arising in the 1950s, where the descendants of those people brought lawsuits for tribal rights to property, the courts decided quite a few of those in favor of the Indians, and they gained quite a lot of property rights. But time has passed. And the property rights are now fairly much assured, and there's quite a lot of justice and quite a lot of injustice. Because in the court system, law works at retail. You need the individual cases. So now we're dealing with a bunch of other cases involving Indians. And the Indians very often lose. And sometimes they win. But I went to a conference of Indian lawyers, and they said, "Well, why is it we lose? Do we have bad lawyers?" And I said, "No. You just got used to winning. Because the law was in such a state that it seemed, at least within the border area, that it was possible to decide for the Indian tribe. And now before, you have different kinds of questions. Let me ask you a question. What do you want? Do you, the Indian tribe, want to be treated as a sovereign nation? Or do you want to be treated as, well, let's say, recipient of a large amount of federal aid? Do you want businesses to have laws that will help you invest in your tribal area? Or do you want us to stay entirely out of it? Now, I noticed two things of interest. First, I had to explain to them, but we can't decide that question. We may be the Supreme Court of the United States, but the proper person to decide that kind of question is Congress. And they sort of took that in. But the other thing I noticed was they had different opinions about it. And as long as they have different opinions about it, it's pretty hard to get. You know, it's not for us. And they had, in that instance, to decide for themselves. You want another? I'll give you another example.
Yeah, perhaps a Japanese internment.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking of. I've also been reading about that. The Japanese internment in World War II was terrible. I mean, there were 70,000 American citizens, and I've read around enough about it for a different reason recently to be reasonably certain of what I'm talking about. Which I hope I normally am, but who knows? The 70,000 American citizens taken from the West Coast and put in relocation camps. That's a euphemism, because they were in the east of California, in Oregon, in the basin, Utah, and so forth. And often there was no place there, nothing. And they had to go and put up shacks, and the dust would come up. It was pretty bad. It was not good conditions. I mean, it wasn't a Nazi concentration camp, but it certainly wasn't a summer resort. And they're moved against their will, every one of them. And why? Because Californians were afraid of invasion. That's why. And the general in charge said that these Japanese American citizens might send messages to submarines. In fact, he said they were sending messages. In fact, he was wrong. In fact, it was a pretty racist kind of thing. I mean, I have very little doubt about that. And eventually, the Supreme Court, in a case that no one believes is good law today, and everyone's very embarrassed about, Korematsu, for those who know it, upheld this as necessary in wartime. Though by that point, the Justice Department itself knew not only was it not necessary, but it had never been necessary. J. Edgar Hoover said, I have 1,000 Japanese agents on a list. Not one of them is a citizen, and they have been arrested or deported. Don't worry. He told General DeWitt, there's no sabotage problem. The FCC had monitored all of the transmissions that were going out of California. And they told General DeWitt at the time, and the Justice Department later, not one of these is in fact sent by any of the Japanese American citizens. And when he was asked, and General DeWitt asked the FCC people, this came out much later, well, why then are my army people here telling me they're monitoring some transmissions? And they said, look, we know. Those people have just been drafted. They know nothing about it. And they're making mistakes. And we will show you each mistake if you want. Okay, that's what happened. And they're there for 3 years and the entire country. I mean, it was an interesting thing because Earl Warren was one of the people who was pushing for the relocation. And he later said, that's the worst thing I ever did in my life. And it probably was.
We'll come back.
All right, now, I've got carried away with this, but I'll tell you, the question is, all right, here were some people, and what do you do by way of reparation? What we did, in fact, is Congress passed a resolution. And many years later, the case was reopened of Fred Korematsu, and they said he shouldn't have been put in prison or relocation. All right? So we have nothing to compare to your experience, to my knowledge, that we're able to do something as direct as that about the American Indians, the Japanese Americans, it's an interesting but very quite different case is the problem of slavery.
We'll come back to that question of wartime and necessity in a minute. But talking about the American Indians brings to mind an experience just north of our border. You know, it's an interesting issue separately in the United States about the relevance of what happens in other countries legally. It's something, Justice Breyer, you have commented on. But we do have this rather large country to our north with a similar history. And they, I believe, on this issue about Aboriginal or First Nation people, as I think they call Indians, Native North Americans in Canada, have a truth commission. And I think there is, in fact, a very substantial amount for reparation. Can you tell us a little bit about that and whether you see any either analogies or perhaps explanations about why that happens, and indeed under a conservative government in Canada?
Well, in response to a fairly creative and energetic period of litigation for the experience of Aboriginal Canadians in their residential schools, and it may be worth just spending 30 seconds to describe these schools, this was largely analogous to what happened in Australia with Aborigines. It was a policy adopted in Canada designed to civilize, quote-unquote, Aboriginal people, to deprive them of their language, of their native customs and way of dress, to turn them into white Canadians. And pursuant to this policy, children were forcibly often taken away from their families and put into these residential schools many miles away from where they lived.
Is this true of American Indians, too?
Exactly. So what's interesting about this, a series of law cases get launched, and eventually the government establishes a former justice of the Canadian Supreme Court, who then mediated a big class action settlement, $5 billion paid to people who went to these residential schools. And when you went to the residential school, you were taken away when you were 4 or 5 or 6. Often, literally, a Mountie and a person from the Bureau of Indian Affairs would knock on the door, they'd come through the door, they'd grab the child, the mother or the father would be held down, they'd put them in a car, drive them miles away to these schools, and you wouldn't see your child again for up to 5 years. And then while your child was in the school, they were subject to systematic physical and sexual abuse. So $5 billion is paid. But the Aboriginal community and the Assembly of First Nations wanted more. They didn't just want the money. They wanted the acknowledgement that this practice was harmful and wrong. So a truth commission is about to start working in Canada, which is designed to give voice to people now in their 60s and 70s who have been through the school to allow them to tell their stories. Because the overwhelming majority of Canadians don't even know what happened in these schools. And so this has become what truth commissions have, what's happened with truth commissions is they started in Chile and Argentina and in South Africa, in places which you conventionally associate with transitions
and a radical change of government.
From authoritarian regimes to democratic ones. And there's been no, you know, the Harper government is hardly radically different from others. But what they're doing is they're embracing this mechanism because they see the power of giving voice to victims and the associated moral and societal transformations that come with that.
Please.
You started by saying there were some ways that worked, and the Truth Commission is an example.
Yeah.
And then you said there are other ways that are dangerous.
Yeah.
What are those?
Well, I think there are a couple one might want to use the example of de-bathification.
Will everyone please turn his cell phone off?
Do as I say, not as I do. So the process of de-bathification in Iraq, for example, ostensibly, this is a process which drew its lesson from post-communist Eastern Europe, the process of lustration, removing people who were communists, former communists, from crucial positions in the state. And so one of the very first orders that the Coalition Provisional Authority, headed by people in this country, did was to order de-bathification. And I think your law clerks, Justice Breyer, given 3 months and some moderate comparative research in what has worked and what has not worked elsewhere, would have warned against the policy of de-Ba'athification as adopted and implemented. It had two particularly terrible consequences. One, it involved disbanding the entire Iraqi army. There is no precedent anywhere of disbanding an entire military force which hasn't had very injurious security consequences. And everybody from George W. Bush to Tony Blair to everybody else admits that this helped to fuel the insurgency. But the second thing about de-Ba'athification is that it managed to be both overbroad and insufficiently specific at the same time. It allowed people with blood on their hands to remain within the government, and it removed people with no blood on their hands who were technocrats from the government at the same time, and therefore was stunningly ineffective, but also very politically divisive. And I think the lesson from that is, with a bit of modesty and a bit of comparative research and looking at what's happened elsewhere, we might be able to approach dealing with these difficult questions in a more productive and intelligent fashion.
Let me ask a follow-up to the Justice's question, and I'll ask you because I'm not sure the Justice would be comfortable answering it. And that relates to the torture debate in the United States today. And there are some, and obviously this has been a very difficult issue for President Obama. And I think many would argue that it is not only counterproductive, but perhaps even dangerous to reopen that issue, and that, in fact, we should get on with it. And I wonder if you see any lessons, examples from other countries dealing with that kind of issue, you know, something, a wartime issue, something done, awkward, difficult, change in government, but the notion that reopening it, opening the windows to it, providing the photographs and the files that are now closed, at least in the near term, is actually more dangerous than productive. And if the Justice would like to answer it, he can answer it too.
Well, let me start and see if there might be a rejoinder. But I think it's important to be clear about what happened. Nobody disputes that people in the employ of the United States government tortured people. And it's very important for us not to mince words about this idea of torture. Dumbing it down by calling it enhanced interrogation doesn't make it any less illegal or immoral. This is a fundamental, the fact that we are even debating whether this is a lawful practice is a huge civilizational step backwards. It is illegal, it's immoral, and it ought to be prosecuted. We have abundant evidence that it in fact occurred. Secondly, we have had impunity for this phenomenon. Justice Breyer referred earlier to the South African case where we have specific knowledge. Right. Let me pursue this argument. I'll come to the orders question. So there, we know of instances where people have tortured. We know of homicides in custody where people have died in consequence of torture. And we know that there's been a chain of command authorizing these acts of torture, and there's been precious little justice or accountability for it. But what's particularly dangerous about this in the United States right now is the former vice president has gone out of his way very publicly to both in political terms and in moral terms to justify these acts. He said, we did waterboarding, it was acceptable, and anybody who abandons these techniques or orders that they be stopped is putting the nation at risk. So he's making a moral and political case for the continuation of these policies. Now, when I worked at the Truth Commission, I was headed up the investigation into torture by the apartheid regime and questioned former President F.W. de Klerk and the former head of the Minister of Law and Order, Adrian Flok, about their authorization of torture. And what distinguishes Dick Cheney from F.W. de Klerk, Adrian Flok, the Minister of Law and Order in South Africa, and Augusto Pinochet in Chile is that in those other people never sought to morally and politically justify torture. They did it, absolutely, but they always did it in a way that was plausibly deniable, that could be concealed. They were always, in fact, morally ashamed of the acts of torture that occurred. And so that's the first point. The second point is that it sought to be legally justified in this country. Attorneys in the Justice Department have sought to define torture out of existence by providing a whole set of justifications for it. So the combination of legal, moral, and political justification of torture, with the fact that it occurs in the United States, a country which is in many respects exemplary, that is looked at by many countries in the world, is very, very dangerous, I would submit. Because I understand that this occurs in the context of September 11th and the context of the war against terror, but there have been scores of countries around the world who've had their own September 11th, or much worse than September 11th. And if every one of those countries then takes the United States example and says, those events allow us to abandon the fundamental tenets of human rights law and sanction and authorize and justify this form of criminal conduct, then all the advances we've made as a civilization since the end of World War II, not following orders is no defense, fund certain crimes are crimes against humanity and unacceptable, will have been eroded. And so it's, in my view, essential that there be a full reckoning of this, not just for the United States and for its citizens, but for the world, that it be reckoned with.
So I can add this, that as you started out by saying, torture is illegal in the United States. We've signed a treaty that makes it illegal. And many years ago, Congress passed a statute, and that statute makes it illegal. So there isn't a problem about having the law in place, but there might be a problem of working out whether this person or the next person is the right person, and what is their degree of responsibility. And that's often harder than you think, because I've so often, in the area of criminal law in particular, thought the following thought, which I don't tell anyone I said this, but there are a whole series of laws that are designed to protect defendants to make certain that the government will have the right person. And the cliche bears some truth to, better to let, 99 go guilty go free than to convict an innocent, et cetera. Maybe that's not the right ratio. Maybe the ratio should be greater or less. All right, I think the following. I won't tell you when. The government argues this particular set of rules should be more liberal, i.e., let us introduce more evidence, or let us do this, or let us do that. The prosecution wants more leeway. I sometimes think to myself, and they sometimes say, look at the terrible crimes that are being committed. So I think, I never say this, I think, I see, there are terrible crimes being committed. So let's put in jail someone who didn't do it. I mean, you see, and I think that in a sense, I'm not saying who did it or who didn't do it in the torture case, I don't know. But I do know in my experience that it's often much harder to get the right person to be certain that there's an appropriate level of guilt and to convict, that's not so easy, than at first you might think. And the legal system, what makes it difficult in general, I think, for it to be the instrument. I'm not saying you shouldn't prosecute people. If you find them, fine, the law's there. But the hard thing about the legal system, which I think you have to remember, is the legal system is very good when you're looking at an individual case. The paradigm of what we do is A versus B. And the question is this person in front of us, not some theory, not how terrible the crime is with which he's charged. So the lustration statutes have put courts in Eastern Europe in a big dilemma, because they operate en masse. And they say anybody who is in this category, terrible things are going to happen to. And then the court has in front of them somebody who's in the category but didn't do something terrible.
But if I may, what I think you quite correctly point out is that there are tricky questions of proof
yes.
that always arise when you have crimes that are committed by multiple actors, various chains of command. These same issues arise when you're trying to prosecute organized crimes or mafia crimes or crimes where there's multiple defendants with different degrees of culpability. This
yes.
all goes to complex questions of proof.
Yes.
It doesn't affect the underlying question that this is criminal conduct that ought to be prosecuted.
No.
And what's occurred in the United States is the official position taken by the administration today is people in the CIA who have tortured and who have tortured in reliance on instructions given to them from higher up ought not to be prosecuted, not because we don't have the proof, but because as a matter of policy, they ought not to be prosecuted. Now, apply that to, what that first does is erode the entire notion of following orders, right? The fact that people followed orders should not and cannot be a defense. And the fact that a bunch of government lawyers have said that manifestly criminal conduct is not criminal cannot make it uncriminal. And so I think what's at stake here, and if this was marginal questions like securities fraud, where there's highly technical infractions and we're trying to shift definitions in response to changing financial flows and new complexities in the markets, that would be one thing. But this is a crime as old as humanity.
Yeah.
It's an elemental crime, it's an international crime, and there's no doubt that waterboarding is a crime. And as you quite correctly state, the United States has signed the Convention Against Torture, has an anti-torture statute. This ought to be prosecuted.
I want to move to another continent here for a minute, and then we will have questions from the audience on either microphone, so people can be thinking about that. Let's think about crimes and individuals. There's been a tremendous amount of controversy about Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, who's been indicted by the International Criminal Court. And questions about is that in the interests of peace in Sudan and Darfur or not? And now there are many African countries who are questioning whether this particular indictment is in fact unfair and singling out Africa. And just recently we were discussing this, Jacob Zuma in South Africa said something quite explicit, which we always assumed was the policy of the Mbeki government with respect to Robert Mugabe, whom most of us in this room would agree has committed massive crimes. And there is, he essentially suggested a few weeks ago he should go off and have a secure and happy retirement in some country, presumably with his ill-gotten billions. That is a conflict, a classic conflict, and you can comment on either the Sudan situation in the International Criminal Court or specifically Mugabe, a classic conflict between peace for the Zimbabweans. The best way to get peace for the Zimbabweans is let Mr. Mugabe go to some secure country, take his billions, and live. He's already 84, it looks like he's gonna live forever, live for another 25 years. Or, and that's in the interests of peace, or is that fundamentally unjust, and does it send a signal to other would-be dictators and criminals? How are we supposed to resolve these questions?
Well, what you raise is one of the most difficult questions in philosophy and law, which are the hardest trade-offs in life are not between good and evil, but between two competing goods. And the two competing goods here are peace and justice. And I think it's very important for people in the human rights community not to trivialize the moral value of peace and to recognize that in certain cases there is in fact a tension between peace and justice. Pushing the demands of accountability too assertively at some moments may cause dictators not to relinquish power, and that may be injurious to the nation as a whole and to the establishment of democracy. And you can see the inverse argument from a justice perspective. I think that's more familiar. What's interesting in the last 10 years is that international law has evolved to a point where amnesties for gross violations of human rights are now broadly held to be contrary to international law. So Alberto Fujimori, the former president of Peru, has just recently been convicted in court in Lima for the operations, amongst other things, of a death squad that operated in fact, Lima. And he was the supposed beneficiary of not one but two amnesty laws that had been passed by the Peruvian Congress to specifically cover the crime that he was eventually convicted for. And the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights and Peru's own courts basically said that amnesty violates international law, it's null and void. And the prosecutions that are occurring in Chile and in Argentina have likewise overturned the amnesties that had been passed in those countries. So one of the things when Robert Mugabe says, I will relinquish office in exchange for an amnesty, one of the rejoinders that the human rights movement can now make that they might not have been able to make 20 years ago is, in fact, the amnesty that we might write you is not worth the paper it's written on. So in fact, the security that it gives you is false security. And so it's probably better to remain silent on this matter, to resolve it in neither direction, neither to give you the amnesty nor to say, well, by the way, as you relinquish office, there'll be somebody waiting
even
to put you into handcuffs.
Another 5 years of suffering for the Zimbabwean people.
Well, you don't need to say relinquish office and we'll prosecute you tomorrow. What you could say is, there won't be prosecutions. We can't make a legally binding undertaking that will occur forever, but we neither can we give you an amnesty. And that's not a volitional question. It's just that if we give it to you, it's not worth the paper it's written on. But I think there's a more sophisticated second alternative, which is being deployed in a range of countries, which is to say, let's try and find some reasonable accommodation. If you and your cohorts come forward and fully confess to your crime, there may be some opportunity for plea bargaining. If you apologize to victims, if you pay some reparation, what we can do is reduce the sentence you might otherwise face. Not to nothing, because that would then be contrary to international law, but we may be able to find some accommodation which gives you sufficient incentive to relinquish office, but doesn't entirely dispense with the imperatives of justice. But there will be hard cases where justice will cause perpetrators who might otherwise have relinquished office not to relinquish office. And then our trade-off is, well, you know, historically the problem in the world has not been that we've had too much justice. Historically the problem is we've had far too little. And we're now just getting to the point where we have the prospect of justice emerging, and that will have other deterrent effects globally. And that's the trade-off that we have to confront.
Mr. Justice Breyer, do you have views?
I have more questions for him because it's very interesting to me to hear this. What you say brings to mind two things. One is certainly the experience I've had in most lawyers and judges is that the cry for justice is primitive, basic. It's part of human nature. Justice, justice shall you pursue. Everyone thinks that. There's no society in which they don't think that. And it's also easy to understate that. And it shouldn't be understated.
Absolutely.
All right. The second thing that it calls to mind is this. I heard someone, a professor at Yale, give a talk. And he said, our basic problem today in your community is this, that after World War II and subsequently, people signed a lot of treaties. And those treaties had all kinds of human rights in them. And they sort of had a sense of, from the human rights point of view, the sky's the limit. Let's put in all these things. But no one had the problem of making them real. No one had the problem of seeing that they're carried out in practice. And today, that's the problem. That's why I think it comes as a surprise to people to know that the statutes of the United States forbid torture that they have. It's not a problem with the statute. Okay? The third thing it calls to mind, which is, I think, something you'll know about, which is what I'm curious is it seems to me that the person who really has to face this problem immediately is the person who is the main prosecutor in the International Criminal Court, if he has it in really double. Because if he in any way really interferes with a peace process, so he can be blamed for that, it doesn't just mean that there might not be peace in the country. It means maybe us, the United States of America, won't sign up. And so how does he deal with that?
Well, I think one of the things that Luis Moreno Ocampo, the chief prosecutor, grapples with is he wants to exercise a supervisory jurisdiction. As you know, the International Criminal Court operates where countries are unwilling and unable to prosecute themselves. So its jurisdiction is not like the courts in Rwanda or in former Yugoslavia, which had primacy. They could go in and get a case, notwithstanding the fact that there was willingness on the part of national courts. They can only act when people are unwilling and unable. And so what that does is firstly place an onus on the domestic courts to pursue justice. And that in some sense insulates him only partly from the dilemma that you articulate, because he can say, well, let's see what the domestic courts are doing. It doesn't remove him entirely from the hard case that you face. And I think what he's done quite wisely in the case particularly of Uganda with the Lord's Resistance Army, where there's been some prospect that peace might arise, has been to say, well, I'll wait. Mm-hmm. And I'll watch, and I'll see if there's a domestic process that meets muster. And if it does, even if it represents a compromise below which I would otherwise be satisfied, I might defer to it because I'd like to see peace and a little bit of justice rather than too much justice and no peace at all.
Yes, because I know so far it seems as if they've dealt with this problem pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, the people who tend to be worried about it in the United States and didn't want to sign up, Our people say that they're very sensitive to the problem of armed forces being prosecuted.
Right.
And so they say, what about my soldiers? So you have to convince the Defense Department. And until you can convince the Defense Department that this isn't some kind of immediate threat, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, I think it's good. But they're not going to sign up. So how do you convince them? And the best way to convince them, which worked in France, and France signed up provisionally and then they joined full membership, is the way to convince them is that there's experience that shows that this fear that they'll somehow prosecute American soldiers and the American soldiers will have no chance and this will be all done for publicity, and they're just, all those arguments are excellent on paper, but it hasn't happened. And that tends to convince them.
And also that there is a provision of the court is such that there is reliance first and foremost on American courts and the American military. You know, all the domestic provisions that exist in the United States have to be exhausted first, and they're to be complete
impunity. That doesn't quite convince them, because you know what they say? They say, yes, you're right. We understand, but what will happen is we'll get a prosecutor in there who wants to get headlines, and then what they'll do is they'll just say the United States procedures are inadequate. And you say to them, or I might, well, look, if the prosecutor's going to do that, you can appeal the prosecutor's decision, something you can't do in the United States. Mm. And they say, well, maybe. And then I say, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you have a special provision in the treaty that the appeal goes to a special panel of judges, of whom one of which will be American? Would that satisfy you? And they say, well, maybe. And then what, because they did something like that, I mean, not quite, but France did something like that. And then I'd say, okay, I understand. You want to see how it works in practice. Yes, isn't that, I mean, this is an imaginary conversation I'm having, but that it seems to me, is where they end up.
Absolutely.
And therefore, the responsibility on the prosecutor in the ICC is enormous.
To be prudent and to be responsible and not to run around with his hair on fire, and at this point he hasn't done so.
Yes, that's what I agree with you. Yeah.
Let me ask one last question. May seem like an odd question when we're talking about incarceration and reparations, but what has been learned in terms of transitional justice about the value of a simple apology? You know, essentially a nation, an executive saying, I'm sorry.
Well, if you look at what's happened in the last 9 months, the prime ministers of both Canada and Australia have given formal, televised, parliamentary apologies to Aboriginal people. And some of the most moving scenes that I've ever seen have been tens of thousands of Aboriginal Australians standing all over the country with huge screens, television screens that have been erected specifically for this purpose, with the Australian Prime Minister saying, he ran on this for his election campaign, because the previous Australian Prime Minister, John Howard, had really been incredibly regressive on this question, said, we have nothing to apologize for our treatment of the Aboriginals. And he said, Kevin Rudd said, let me say it three times so that there's no misunderstanding. It was immoral, it was unacceptable, and we owe you an unqualified apology. And then you had these pictures of these Aboriginal families standing with tears streaming down their faces, looking at somebody saying this. Now, does it fundamentally change everything? If you're living in poverty and you haven't really been given the compensation you owed, no. But I think it makes an enormous moral difference to be able to own up and to recognize the nature of these crimes.
Well, it works. Well, I had three examples. One is the Japanese resolution that went through Congress. Did that help? It seemed to help.
Yes.
It seemed to help. Yeah. The Japanese did seem... I met Fred Korematsu.
Right.
I actually met him. And he was a wonderful person. My next-door neighbor was the daughter of the ACLU lawyer in San Francisco who represented him in the famous case. And he thought it made a difference. It helped. Second example, as I said the other day, Little Rock Nine. With the Little Rock Nine, the black school children who rather very heroically went in to integrate that first school in Little Rock, some of them, have traveled the country with... In a couple of cases, the women who were photographed in total opposition with looks of hatred on their face, and they've gone together, and they talk about the prejudice and stereotype that had led to that. Because the woman who made that famous face, because it was a famous photograph, she really is sorry. And to prove it, she goes wherever she can with till they're 40 years, 50 years, 60 years old. Third example, I saw on television, which struck me as very moving, was a woman whose son had been murdered. And the man who murdered him eventually got out of prison. And she said she thought she'd forgive him. And the two of them, and you can do that now, you see, with these Twitters or whatever you have. I guess you can get all over the world pretty quickly. But they travel around together. And they talk together about the value of forgiveness and how that changed his life and how, etc. Now you say, well, you have to see it, because it's hard to see without being moved by that simple expression, well, I'm sorry. And he is, believe me. Well, I forgive you. My goodness, that's such a powerful voice in human emotion, human life. It's amazing.
Hi, Carol Fotino. Paul, you had commented on the trade-off between justice for truth in South Africa. And I was very glad you brought that up. I feel very strongly that the success that we talk about there in South Africa does have to be footnoted by the trade-off with justice. And so I wanted to get you, if you would, to speak a little further about perhaps the way your organization is now moving forward in perhaps slightly different ways to maybe perhaps make that imbalance a little less significant or extreme, if you would.
It's a wonderful question. I recently argued as the first foreign lawyer before the Indonesian Constitutional Court on a statute in Indonesia that had incredibly been virtually the South African Truth Commission legislation translated into Bahasa Indonesian and put before their parliament, which contained precisely this trade-off. And my argument before that court was two things. One, international law has evolved since South Africa, and that the compromise that was acceptable in 1995 in South Africa, a complete immunization of criminal and civil responsibility in exchange for the truth, is no longer acceptable under international law, that there has to be more. There has to be an accompanying payment of reparation. There has to be some form of sentencing, some form of plea bargaining, that trade-off at that moment was that international law has caused us to recalibrate that balance. But secondly, the South African situation worked only because there was a reasonable threat of prosecution against persons who might otherwise who were thinking about coming to apply for amnesty. Nobody came in South Africa. No hit squad leaders came because they suddenly had this great moral crisis and reflected deeply on the immorality of what they had done and really wanted to come clean. It would make a good Oprah moment if that were true, but it was not. They came because they feared that they would be prosecuted, and because there was a successful trial of a hit squad leader occurring in South Africa at that moment. As soon as 4 or 5 people came forward and applied, it created a domino effect because each person didn't know who was going to implicate the next. And so the whole security police apparatus, all the way up to the minister responsible for the police and the commissioner of police, applied for amnesty. In Indonesia, there's no reasonable prospect that anybody is going to prosecute the Indonesian military, the TNI. So therefore, if you create an incentive structure set up in that way, nobody's going to come forward because they have de facto amnesty already. And so what you'll do is embarrass yourself as a government because you'll offer a deal that no one will take. And the only people who will take it will be those very few unfortunate military officers who, for reasons quite separate from justice, have fallen foul of the establishment and are being prosecuted, and they'll come forward and ask for amnesty. And so you'll get very little truth, and the only prospect of justice that you might get will be extinguished by this arrangement. And the lesson to be learned there is don't uncritically apply blueprints which emerged in one context, which was entirely sui generis, and apply them in other contexts where the facts and the circumstances are entirely different.
It looks like there's no microphone over there, and we don't have a lot of time, so perhaps I can ask the 2 or 3 people I can't exactly see to just give your question, and then we'll have the panelists comment on the remaining questions. So just one after another, if you would.
Hi, my name is Bobby Esnard, and I'm a 2009 Bezos Scholar, and I go to the Bronx High School of Science. Justice Breyer, it sounds before like you were saying that the primary reason why the United States isn't involved in the International Criminal Court is because those in charge of the defense of our nation wouldn't support it. But how would you answer arguments that say that joining the court is fundamentally unconstitutional, given that it violates multiple due process rights, the right for the president to issue a pardon, among other things? The highest appeal being to the Supreme Court. What would you say to arguments that say that joining a court like that is unconstitutional?
Okay, thank you. And if we can hear the other questions, and then we'll have our panelists answer as they can.
My question is to both panelists. If you were the president of the United States and you could see the future and knew that a nuclear bomb was in an American city and you had the ability to prevent it by authorizing waterboarding, would you feel better letting it happen and killing 1 million people, or would you feel better allowing the enhanced interrogation technique to take place and to allow the information to become available that could save 1 million people?
I'm not a panelist.
Well, I'm
I'm not going to give you good answers to the first answer to the question. My answer is simply, I'm sure the negotiators, when they negotiate our entry into the ICC treaty, will try to take due account see that it conforms with due process. Now, as to the main thrust there, you're saying, well, how could we uphold it if it's unconstitutional? And the answer is we couldn't. As to whether it's unconstitutional or not, I will leave to future events that can unfold. It's certainly not going to be held unconstitutional if we haven't joined it. As to the second question, I mean, I don't know what the legal arguments are there, so I haven't had to face them, and I've learned over time, don't opine on a legal issue except in an opinion after you've heard argument in the case. The second question is, of course, I call that, in my mind, two things. A, it's a law school hypothetical, and B, I don't have to answer it. And I never will, thank goodness.
So that leaves you, Paul.
Well, as to the first question, many countries have had to grapple with constitutional provisions that may create difficulties in ratifying the ICC statute and a range of other international treaties. And the question there is, with the right application of legal ingenuity and goodwill, these things can always be surmounted and circumvented. And I frankly, I think it would be very good to get to this point in the debate about the International Criminal Court, that we're trying to find the sort of technical legal obstacles that we have to overcome. I think the much broader question is the overall political hurdle, which is, does the United States believe that it's a good thing for there to be a global court to prosecute people responsible for international crimes, and should it support it? And I think the answer, in my view, should be an unqualified yes in both of those cases. I have the great privilege of not being a Supreme Court justice, so I can tackle that, the second question. I think the first thing that we have to say about torture is that it's immoral and it's wrong, and it's very important not to abandon that notion, because if you abandon that notion, then you cross a moral threshold with a whole range of different questions about both law and morality, and you put yourself on a very dangerous, slippery slope. Now, if there were to be a heroic CIA agent who were to torture somebody very badly, and in the course of that get the actionable intelligence that were to avert a nuclear bomb in the middle of Times Square, I think that any judge who was called upon to prosecute that person would think about the mitigation and sentence in a pretty massive way. And I think that the way that we'd want to think about that is to say it's criminal and it's wrong and it's unlawful. And then we take that circumstance into account in the highly hypothetical circumstance should it arise. But let me say that what's very interesting about the torture debate in the United States right now is that this is the argument that's being made to justify torture and enhanced interrogation, that we have got actionable intelligence from all of these cases. And what's interesting is, to date, we have not had one piece of information furnished to us which has indicated that the torture has yielded actionable intelligence. And do you think that if it were out there, it would not be provided to us? And what we have is, in fact, the contrary. We have lots of examples of people being tortured and have provided us with absolutely false information. Some of that information worked its way into the presentation that Colin Powell made to the UN to justify us going into war in Iraq. So I think that firstly, it's immoral and it's wrong. Secondly, we have lots of evidence to suggest that torture provides bad evidence. And it fundamentally subverts criminal prosecutions because, as Guantanamo has shown us, once you start torturing people, it becomes awkward, embarrassing, and legally problematic to prosecute those people afterwards. And thirdly, in those highly 1 in 10 million circumstances that it arises, I think we have the mitigation solution to it.
Justice Breyer, do you have a last word?
Well, maybe a minute or so, because, well, I can't answer that second question, obviously I can't. But the first question I was a little too flip with, because it's actually a rather deep question. And it's a deep question, the question of the constitutionality, the legality of, and I'll show you, give you an example, though I can't answer it because I don't know, but let me show you the world we're living in, because I have looked up some of the broader issues here, and there are at the moment over 1,000 legal institutions that make rules binding under treaties for more than one country. And we're a party to quite a few of those. And the question comes up not only in that ICC context where it hasn't come up because we're not even members, but it comes up quite a lot, or every so often, how are we going to deal legally with this world? What's the status of these rules? Whether it's a rule of NAFTA, whether it's a rule of the International Court of Justice, which we signed a treaty promising that we would follow their interpretation of something. And there are dozens of both commercial, because the world is developing legally, internationally, A, on the commercial track, and B, on the human rights track. And sometimes one gets sort of ahead, and then the other times the other gets sort of ahead. But they're both becoming more and more international. So what is the status of those rules? We had a case called Medellin, which involved the death penalty, which distracted from the main issue, which was, what is the legal status of a ruling of the International Court of Justice pursuant to a treaty provision where we said, we promise we'll follow it. And our court, I dissented, but our court, the majority, held that that ruling does not have legal status nonetheless in the United States unless Congress passes a statute, which I thought was wrong, but they thought was right. That's a tiny example of what's ahead. Let me tell you about one other statute. I think in 1780s, you'll probably know, they passed a statute which was called, what is it called?
Alien Claims
Tort Act. The Alien Tort Claims Act. And that says that any person in the world who gets to New York or Los Angeles can bring a lawsuit against any other person, claiming that that other person, say he's a Paraguayan citizen and they're Paraguayan dictators, that that other person has to pay him a lot of money for the torture that he committed. Now, why did they pass that statute? Because they thought about pirates. And they thought, you catch a pirate where you can and you get all the money out of him you can. Today, there are only a few pirates. There are some. And the question is, who are today's pirates? Part of the answer to that question, part of the answer is going to lie in how do you create a workable system where that judge in Spain and that judge in Belgium and the judge over here come to certain comparable results. Because there's no Supreme Court of the world, perhaps, thank goodness, but there's no Supreme Court of the world. So there's no way to iron these things out. I'm giving you a taste of what was implicit, the kinds of things, in that question about the constitutionality of a treaty promise to belong to the International Criminal Court.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you to Stephen Breyer and Paul von Sauer.